Hello, everyone, and welcome back to James Cameron's Titanic Scene by Scene. I'm Brittany Butler.
I'm Ethan Brim.
And today we have another very special guest on the podcast with us. I am so excited for today. It's going to be a lot of fun. I know it's going to be good. We have a guest with us that you guys, our listeners, might be familiar with, might even also listen to, which would be really cool if that's the case. If not, you're going to learn all about her today. So we have with us L.A. Beatles of the Unsinkable Titanic podcast. Hi, L.A.
Hey. Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me on. I have been listening to your show for years. So number one, I'm so glad that you guys are back. I was one of the people that was really sad when you guys were on hiatus, but the way that you guys came back ended up being perfect with the 25th anniversary of the release. So it really worked out perfectly. But yes, definitely one of the people that was so excited to see you back. I've been listening forever. So this feels a little bit surreal to be on with you guys. And I think the Venn diagram of people that listen to your show and listen to mine, like I think there's some pretty big space there just from things I've heard. You know, I hear from listeners. A lot of my listeners are huge fans of your show as well. So I think there's definitely some crossover there. So this is awesome. I'm just happy to be here.
I love it. That's awesome. I know. I hope so, too. That would be really nice. I'm really excited to do this today, to not only be talking about any scene, but like a pretty big one.
This is a pretty big one.
This is a big, extremely memorable fan favorite scene. So I'm very excited to have another voice in the mix for this particular conversation, definitely. So this is the scene titled Not Without You, scene 28, or at least that's one of the Blu-ray scene selection titles. I always used to refer to this as like the You Jump, I Jump scene, but we already took that title for Rose's suicide attempt scene. So had to go with something else. Yeah. But before we get into it, we have to introduce you properly to our listeners who may not be familiar. So just tell us a little bit about yourself and your Titanic origin story, because we always have to hear that.
Of course. Now, I always ask for it on my show as well. So mine is pretty cookie cutter, I think, for women around my age. So I was born in 84, which put me at exactly 13 years old in 1997 when Titanic came out. You know, my family, we were just movie people. Like, that's what we did on the weekend. So when we went to see Titanic that first Friday it was out in December 97, I had never really studied Titanic at all. I wasn't a Titanic kid. And it was just, this is the new movie and this is what we're going to see on a Friday night at the mall movie theater. And I just was blown away. I mean, I think I walked out of the theater catatonic because I was, you know, I still remember that feeling. I can still put myself in that mall movie theater in 97, eating popcorn, drinking Cherry Coke, watching this for the first time. I fell in love with Leo immediately. I was the quintessential Leo mania girl. I had all the posters on my wall. I mean, to this day, I am a Leo person. My husband jokes that when he married me, he had to marry me and Leo, really, like, on some level. Yeah, I am just like ride or die Leo, no matter what. So it really got me more into film. It got me into Titanic, the ship as well. And it was, I mean, I wrote Titanic fan fiction on the early internet, guys. I still stay in touch with a few of the people that I wrote fan fiction with in the late 90s. So I was a total nerd. It was part of my personality when I was a teenager. It's still a huge, obviously, part of my personality. Nice. So I really stuck with me and I got interested in the ship as well. And then I, you know, went to college, went to grad school. I actually have a PhD in American history. I studied this period. So I studied 1880 to about 1930. So I have this great backbone of that period. But, you know, Titanic has never really been accepted as an academic subject in history programs. So I never really considered doing it for my dissertation. I should have, looking back. But yeah, so I taught at the university level for a little while, wrote. I took some time off to have my kids. And then when I sort of reemerged and wanted to get going again with research and writing, it was the pandemic. So I started the podcast. I wanted a reason to, pardon the pun, but dive back into everything Titanic, read all of the new books. And what came out of it was the pod. It was a pandemic project. I wasn't sure how long I would keep it up, but I've had such a great response, and I have listeners from all over the world and quite a few listeners now. And as you guys know, anything Titanic just really attracts people. I'm a super fan of the movie as well. So a lot of my episodes deal with the cultural history involving the movie. You know, I did like a huge four-part series on the making of the film as a set of episodes. So I'm a big James Cameron head. Fill in the blank. I'm the quintessential like Titaniac. So I found your podcast a few years ago. I'm a runner, so I binged all your episodes while running. And so yeah, that's kind of the, you know, basic Titanic story for me. It's a huge part of my life. I have the Make It Count tattoo, the same one that Brittany has.
Yep, part of the club.
We're tattoo buddies. But yeah, that's pretty much sums it up in terms of me and Titanic.
Wow. Love it.
Have you been to any of the museums?
Ethan!
Oh, yeah!
He has to get his Pigeon Forge plug-in for the day.
I work with Pigeon Forge. I'm not officially, I do contract work with them, but okay. I hosted a film festival with them.
That's right, I saw that, right.
Oh, cool.
And I'm going to do a live show there in July, this July. But yeah, I collaborate with them a lot. I've been there several times. I'm wearing my Belfast necklace. So I've been to Titanic Belfast, and I've been to the Titanic Museum in Cove in Ireland. I haven't seen the big piece in Vegas yet. There's still a lot.
I went in the gift shop to the Vegas one. we were just there a couple weekends ago, and I was like, whoa, I didn't even realize that there was a Titanic museum, or I'd forgot that there was at least. But
that's where the big piece that they pulled up was. Like, it's an actual piece of the hull. You can stand behind it and sort of look through the porthole, and it sort of, from what I've heard, you know, kind of feels like you are on Titanic, basically.
Now the one in Pigeon Forge, they do honor the movie a lot, and they have like, they recreate certain things, and like they definitely talk about it in some facet. Do the ones in Ireland and or was it Belfast and Cove, do those ones?
Not as much. I definitely think the Pigeon Forge and the Branson ones, you know, embrace that part of it way more.
Oh, for sure.
Although I will say, you know, not that there's a negative energy. Like when we were in Belfast, we took the outdoor tour as well. And they have, you can go through the Harland and Wolff offices, and they take you around the whole harbor and all of the different sort of outdoor spots. And at one point you're in the dry dock where Titanic was built, and they have steel beams in the ground so that you can see the outline of the ship.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's so cool. At the bow, the tour guide said, okay, do I have any kids or anybody that wants to come and do the Jack and Rose, you know, at the bow? And my kids, because they're so programmed with all of this, they thought they just had to do it because their mom is who she is. My son is like, okay, I'll do it. So he stands at the bow, right, just like arms out. So then the tour guide had like, that's fine, son. You're good. He looked so unhappy.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So they, you know, there's not a negative energy towards it, but it's definitely like not as prevalent in the gift shops and stuff.
Yeah.
They sell DVDs of it, and they sell the soundtrack, and they have a few minor items, but it's not like Pigeon Forge where, you know, you walk in the gift shop and it's like the, you know, he's my Jack, she's my Rose shirts.
The Pigeon Forge and from what I've heard about the Branson one, they're definitely more like have that roadside attraction vibe, I think, because the Americana thing. And
it's the kid. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Pigeon Forge is Pigeon Forge. You know, so, I mean, it's a beautiful building. And
it's super cool.
It's cool. And they have some great artifacts. And the crew at Pigeon Forge, I mean, I have worked with them. They do an amazing job. Like, they really do care. They love sharing the stories. And every single person I've interacted with there has been so passionate about the actual ship.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only speak highly of them. It's a great place. Yeah. They have to like go to Titanic College in order to work there. So there's probably docents there that know more than I do, like 100%. I know we have to move on, but one story I do have to share, especially since you've been there, Ethan. So I went to an event there last August, and because we had dinner in this like secret room they have at the bow of the ship, which is cool. But I had access to the grand staircase with no one else around. It was just me and my friend Alexia.
Oh, of Titanic Talk Line?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Didn't you go on her show? You were on her show.
Yeah, okay. I popped on there the other day.
Yeah. Yeah. She and I, we just know each other through this. So we ended up at the same conference back in August, this Titanic thing. And we both have a Titanic podcast. So it's like, we should, you know, we should definitely have lunch, you know. So we were like at the staircase. No one else was around. All of the lights were out in the rest of the ship. And so it really felt like, it felt like you were at the Grand Staircase. Mm-hmm. And we like took pictures, and it was really awesome because the lights in the gift shop were out, and you could kind of imagine that you were just there. It was really kind of incredible.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it is, because it gets, that's like the one of the main attractions there is the staircase. So everyone's trying to see it.
Oh yeah, that's the main, I mean, they did a beautiful job with it, and I would say that's probably the main attraction, like inside.
Yeah.
They have to have the banisters, right, though? Like, they have to have, like, the handles put on.
Yeah.
For, like, safety regulations or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the only thing. But they've done a good job of integrating it, because I've also been, so I've been to, there's one of the Titanic hotels in Liverpool in England. I've been there, and they took me back to show me their staircase, which they have for private events. And it does not look good. Like, listen, Titanic Liverpool, I love you. The concierge there is like, he follows me on Instagram now. I'm like, John, I love you. You're great. But the staircase, like, it's not, they've got weird carpet down that doesn't look right. They do, like, it doesn't, like, he, like, revealed the room. And I'm like, thank you, but this is not the Grand Staircase. It's just not. I think the dimensions are right, but that's probably pretty much it. But in terms of accuracy, I think Pigeon Forge and Branson, like, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah. Which is, this is relevant to this scene, because much of this scene happens right there. Like, that's when I was standing there last time, last August, I thought about this scene, actually, weirdly, when I was standing right there, so.
Oh.
Yeah,
totally.
I love it. I can see that. Oh, my goodness. Okay. So, getting into the scene. Woo, hopefully we have enough time.
Oh, we're good. We're good. We're good. We got this. That's why I did the transition. I was like, speaking perfect, of the scene. Here we go. Yeah.
All right. So, the scene starts where we see two little girls being separated by their father, getting onto the lifeboat. And we hear him saying, you know, it's goodbye for a little while, only for a little while. This boat's for the mummies and the children. There'll be another boat for the daddies. And I've always heard that this was inspired by Eva Hart, the real life survivor. I know you are a historian, so I figured.
Yeah, I've always heard that that's the inspiration as well. In fact, the little girl that you see in that scene looks so much like, if you go back and you look at pictures of Eva Hart at the time, I feel like he almost cast according to those photos, maybe.
Oh,
I mean,
probably.
Knowing James Cameron, that's not, you know, that's definitely in the realm of possibility. But yeah, I've always heard it's that's the Hart family, or inspired by, for sure.
And piggybacking off of the end of our last episode with that husband's letter deleted scene, I had just written in my notes that it's just a little bit too much. They didn't need all of that build up.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think it was Cameron. This is just my opinion. I think it was Cameron in those scenes trying to fit in as many of the historical references as he could.
Yep.
There is like a historical record of a man trying to hand a letter to someone, to his wife, in those moments. So he probably read about that story. He'd read about the Hart family. Like, it's, there's a family called the West family where the dad, it's an incredible story, where the dad took his wife and children to the lifeboat and then realized that his baby would need milk on the lifeboat. So he goes back to his cabin and gets this thermos of warmed milk. And by the time he gets back to the lifeboat, it's already started to descend. So he jumps on the ropes and gets this thermos down to his family, does not get in the lifeboat, and then waves goodbye. And that's the last they ever saw of him.
Wow.
And whenever I watch this scene, I think about that real life family too. But I think, like, yeah, Cameron is trying to fit in as many nods to real people, I think, in these scenes. But when he sat down to edit, I think he realized this is too much density of this stuff. Yeah. We have to get back to Jack and Rose.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a fan, though, of the actual Titanic itself, it was his only shot, right?
Yeah. Like,
these stories that he fell in love with along the way, like, he's like, I might not ever get a chance, like, to see this in cinematic form, at least like myself, or like, I don't know if they were thinking about deleted scenes in 97, DVD just came out in 96, but yeah, to just for his own sake, maybe even as like selfishly, maybe he wanted to shoot these.
Yeah, I think he had the people, he had the sets. I think he just shot as much as he could, and he knew that he would have however many miles of film to edit. But yeah, I think you're right. I think he thought, like, I recreated the Titanic, and while we're here, we've got to try to pack in as much as we can.
Exactly.
But I think, like, leaving in the girl crying is, I mean, that packs such a punch that's enough, really. Yeah. Like, her being separated from her father, I think that was the right, like, powerful thing to keep in here.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I love the way that's literally the very top of that scene. And again, like when we talk about background characters and stuff, while these people, I guess you would call them maybe background characters, they're still the main focus of this moment, you know?
Yeah. Featured extras, yeah.
Yeah, which is something our guest Lauren Cohen mentioned, that, you know, she really loves
that
about James Cameron's filmmaking.
Yeah.
So we have Rose, she turns around to face Jack and she says, "I'm not going without you." And he says, "No, like, get on the boat, Rose." And she goes, "No, I can't, Jack. No, Jack." And I'm like, this is another contender for the,
for a drinking game.
This is another contender for them saying their names.
I, like, seriously, like, you know, I love this movie. One of my great loves of my life is this movie. But people are right about this Jack Rose thing. It is too much.
It is.
And once you pick up on it, it's like you can never go back.
Yeah, it's so hard to unhear it.
You can't unhear it, yeah.
You can't not hear it. Yeah. And this scene is definitely a top contender.
Mm-hmm. And like we had said in our episode, which one was it? It was "Can Anybody Hear Me" when Rose rescues Jack. And we were saying that they say their names a lot in that whole scene when they're the only two people there. And this is like the other thing. Like, she's talking directly to him. She doesn't have to keep saying, "No, Jack. No, Jack."
Yeah, seriously. But I will say that the handcuff scene wins, though, because not to go back to a scene you've already done, but those moments where it's like, "Check here, Rose. No, check here, Rose." Why would you ever in your life say someone's name that much that you were in a room with? I don't even say my husband's name that much. Like, in a day. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, maybe when I'm mad at him, but I, like, anyway, but yeah, it's, yeah. And so this is another one where it's like, "No, Jack, no, Jack.
Get on the boat, Rose."
Yeah. And I don't know, like, I think, what do you think? Do y'all think that, are those in the script, or do you think those are like day of?
Well, for that particular scene, the handcuff scene, those were not in there. So we were like, no, that was just them saying it while they were shooting, no one called them out. No one thought to edit it out. It was, yeah.
It's just a little performative, I think, yeah, because when you have, you know, the script, and then it's kind of a crutch in a sense, like an acting crutch.
But wait, did you check the script for the scene? Is that what you're doing?
Mm-hmm. So the roses are in the script for Jack, but there's no Jacks for Rose. So the lines are, Rose says, "I'm not going without you. Get in the boat, Rose." And then Cal comes up, "Yes, get in the boat, Rose." And then Rose just says, "No, not without you." So there's no lines in here where she says his name, except she says it at least three times here, I think, or
it's
something.
Probably just like in that kind of adrenaline soaked urgent moment, I guess maybe it would make sense. Like, if you're trying to, I mean, that's really a life or death decision. Like, do I get on a lifeboat? Does this person that I'm in love with also get on the, like, deciding, are they both going to try to get on? Is one only getting on? Like, those, they've rushed up to the deck. I mean, obviously, like, the scene y'all just came out of talking about, I mean, that's an adrenaline moment, I guess. It's not.
Yeah, when you're trying to convince somebody of something, you say their name, I think.
To try to get through to them.
To try to, like, Rose, you need to listen, you know, like, versus,
check right here, Rose.
Yeah, exactly. Check. Yeah, like, I took a writing class a year, like 10 years ago, and one of the things is, like, characters don't say each other's names that much. So anytime you have a character saying another character's name, make sure it's necessary in the script, and you take those out.
Cameron didn't get that note.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah. Good writer, but yeah, I've always criticized his dialogue a little bit, but
I'm a James Cameron apologist.
Yeah.
to the detriment of some people I've interacted with.
Because his storyboarding, like his storyboarding is good.
His storyboarding is immaculate. Yeah.
It's perfection.
And everything else he does down to the most smallest technicality is so good. So it's like you can forgive his shortcomings.
You can forgive the dialogue a little bit. Yeah, I agree.
I rather a fluid narrative than like great dialogue. Like I've seen fantastic movies that have mediocre dialogue and they're still amazing. Like this.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I agree 100%. The dialogue is the thing about this movie. And you guys, to your credit, I mean, you've done a really amazing job of talking about that along the way in a lot of different scenes. It's the thing that, you can kind of pick apart. But, you know, for me, like you said, I view it as the whole narrative. And so I try to just not go in there and nitpick, even though you definitely can. Makes for a fun drinking game, too. Not that I endorse people drinking that much. Yeah.
I mean, it makes for fun conversations, too, especially some of those deleted lines. Woo!
I love it when y'all talk about the deleted lines. Y'all been doing that a lot recently. Yeah. I love it. It makes me laugh so much.
I'm sure there's probably a lot more to come, but... Okay, so just about now when Jack and Rose are going back and forth, like, no, I'm not going without you. No, Rose, get on the boat. Cal shows up. Yes, get on the boat, Rose. I'm like, oh, okay. And that's kind of how they feel. They're just like... All right. They just look at him like, where the heck did you come from? And why are you reinserting yourself into our lives? And as I was taking my notes, I wrote that it's almost like the two of them being brought back to some sort of reality. Like, oh, right. This guy still exists. And now it's just very awkward because Jack and Rose have elevated to like a different, you know, level of their relationship now. They're like just in this. And then Cal's just like, oh, hey.
It is. It's like, and this is the person that up until a few hours ago, she was actively engaged to and her entire family's fortune is tied to it. It is. It's a very weird moment because suddenly they're forced together literally into this little triangle again, and they've been off in their world, then the ship's been sinking, so this is the just that reunion moment of the triangle. And it's I love Billy Zane, and I think you guys are pro Billy Zane, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I love him in this scene. I mean, I hate his character, but I love him in this scene. From this point in the movie on, it is just ultimate Zane-ness.
Yes.
Yeah. He's also the most nuanced. Like, his performance right here in the scene we talked about last time, too. You have to kind of, like, interpret his eyes, like, his expressions a little bit more than in the rest of the film. And I think that's, like, this is his best performance so far, is this scene and the one before, where you're like, okay, he's conflicted between pride and, like, the possession of, or his, you know, his assumed possession of his fiance, and, like, actually maybe, like, his emotional attachment to her, or the idea of her, and you see that play out, obviously, in this scene.
And that's, perfect, because... So he notices that Rose is wrapped in a blanket, and so he's like, okay, opportunity to be like the bigger man, kind of, and is just like, oh, look at you. You know, you look a fright. Like, here, put this on. Takes his coat off, puts it on her without a second thought, and I feel like there's one or two different things at play here. So... Obviously, he completely forgets that he put the diamond into this coat that he is now putting on Rose. And so you are left to wonder, what was it that clouded his mind so much that he would forget about that, right? Was it his love for Rose, or was it his desire to be Jack? Was it his desire to just look like a good guy in front of other people? Because he looks around. You see him like he's you know what I mean? He's putting the coat on Rose, but he looks around.
Yeah.
He looks over here to see, oh, is anyone looking, right? And so in the screenplay, something interesting is that it says, Cal puts the coat on Rose for modesty, not the cold.
I noticed that because I revisited the script yesterday too, and I noticed that. And I wonder if that's just, you know, James Cameron fitting in a reminder that this is 1912, or is there more to be read into behind that line? And I don't know. What do you think? I really didn't know what to make of that because it's so random and oddly placed.
I think, because this is the thing, I was really interested to see if I could find, you know, somewhere some description of Billy Zane's, you know, motivation in this scene, or Cal's motivation in this scene, like what he was playing, you know. And James Cameron didn't say anything on the commentary about it. There's nothing written in the screenplay to tell you about it. There's nothing on anywhere that I could really find. So it's really up to us to just kind of interpret what he's doing right there today on this podcast for the record. So I was thinking a few different things. Well, I think him at least writing that, so in the screenplay of, you know, Cal's doing this for the modesty, not the cold, to me that translated to he's not actually doing this because he cares about her.
Oh, okay. Yes. He doesn't care that she's cold.
Exactly.
He cares that this woman who he has been engaged to is now on the deck in basically what looks like a slip, mm-hmm. and his hair is messy. Parts of her body are outlined by this wet slip. This is, if it wasn't a sinking ship and she walked out on the street like this, it would be like, you know, social suicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wouldn't be acceptable. So he's still just serving his own ego, is what you're saying. Like, that's
pretty much, yeah. I think especially the way he looks around and he's all like frazzled about it. And yeah, I think it's not about, oh, she's cold, I gotta take care of her. It's like, oh my God, cover yourself, like, blah, blah, blah. It's like still kind of, still a little bit of a possessive thing going on there, then I'd say, maybe.
Maybe he looks around, too, because he does remember that the necklace is in the coat.
Because if she's, because if he knows at that moment she's definitely getting on a dry lifeboat.
Exactly.
Maybe he's thinking, I will just find her after this is over and now it's safe. I mean, I guess that's, I've never thought that, but I guess it's possible.
I mean, James Cameron definitely said that, like, he was not thinking about the diamond at all in this moment.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
So that's why you also have to think what overcame him so much in that moment that he would forget, you know, because that was James Cameron's intention, I guess, for him to completely forget.
I think you're right. I think just possessiveness. I think just like reverting to, I am the man with power. This is a person I have been in possession of. I always win, and I'm going to this time, and I'm going to insert myself in this situation. And I remember watching this scene as a kid, and just when he like kind of forces the coat on her and he kind of steps into her, it's a big moment. He's trying to still stake that claim, and her reaction is just, I mean, the acting by Kate Winslet is so good in that moment, but her reaction is definitely like, what do I do? Like, don't touch me. Like, what? I'm now in this weird situation where I do not want to be around this person that 3 hours ago I was engaged to. You know, it is such a dynamic, just couple of seconds, really.
Mm-hmm. On the commentary, James Cameron said, you know, Cal's completely forgotten about the diamond and made a point to say that we have too. You know, us as an audience, like,
oh, yeah.
Like no one is thinking about the diamond at this moment. Yeah. No one, which is so crazy.
It's why it's a total MacGuffin, but it's also like such a good plot device, because you don't care about the stupid diamond. Like nobody cares about the diamond. It only matters in the moment that it matters for a couple of seconds. Like no one actually cares about this diamond. That's the thing. It's wild, but it's true.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so like we as an audience have totally forgotten that that diamond exists at this point.
But it's funny though, right? Because then when it comes back around though, we're like, oh!
Yeah.
Suddenly we care.
Too. Yeah, because I'm watching this for the first time in a while as we're recording. And I was like, oh snap, the freaking necklace is in that pocket. That was funny.
Yeah, but I mean, I think sometimes even when I've rewatched it, I forget in that moment that it's in there.
Going off of what we were talking about in the last episode about how his main motivation is this desire to beat Jack for a lot of it. And I think that comes into play too with the way he takes the blanket and just shoves it at Jack, like, get out of here, basically. You know what I mean? I'm the man. I'm putting this coat.
Yeah. And I don't want this dirty, poor blanket. Like, this blanket represents third class. Mm-hmm. And this is your filth. Like, you are lesser. You are filthy. This should not be on. I think you're right. I think at this point, Cal is still holding out hope that she is going to revert back to him.
Yeah, because then he does that thing where he tries to, like, cup her face and touch her hair.
Yeah.
He has that little weird smile on his face trying to, like, oh, yes, like, you're mine. Like, you still love me, right? And it's like, no, I never did.
Yeah, like, do not, please do not touch me, dude. Yeah, like, the look she gives is spot on.
Yep. So then Jack is the one that sort of pulls Rose aside after the Cal debacle there. Mm-hmm. He knows what's going on. And so Jack starts telling her, like, you know, don't worry about me. I'm a survivor. All right. And this is like something that I wanted to point out so that we could return to shortly, because it's something you mentioned, LA, like something to maybe talk about, you know, whether or not Jack could have survived if Rose did not make this decision. So I'm like, yeah, so he's right there. He said he's a survivor and not to worry about him. So, but yeah.
He gave her all the information that she needed.
I know. So then I wrote that Cal, yep, he gets more layered and nuanced right here because he lies. He decides to lie, seemingly, you know, for the sake of Rose. And this is what I had said, though. As far as he knows, you know, he has made this bribe, which now, because as we're talking in order, there are some things that I don't want to say because I don't want to jump around too much. So sometimes it sounds like I don't know what I'm talking about in a certain scene because it sounds like I don't know what's coming next. But yeah. I'm like, no, I just don't want to talk about that yet. And then when I get there, I'll circle back. So this is one of those things. So he has made this bribe with Murdoch that's what we're supposed to believe. And so there's a scene we get to later where, you know, Murdoch kind of rejects the bribe and gives Cal his money back. With that knowledge, because in that scene, Cal goes up to him and says, "We had a deal, damn you," right? And so I'm like, okay, yeah. So what he really was thinking was that money was insurance for a spot on a boat, period. Like, he's going to go up to Murdoch no matter what, no matter what boat it was. Let me on here because I gave you money. Like, I'm cutting to the front of the line. Let me on, sort of thing. And so that's why I said he knows he's going to live in this scene, right?
Or at least he feels pretty confident about it.
Yeah. Like, he feels like he got everything set up. Like, this is, like, fine. So, like, this is one of these moments where every time I watch it, like, with my mom, like, when we just saw it in theaters and everything, mom always gets, like, misty in this moment, and she turns to me, and she always goes, "See, he actually kind of does love her." And I'm like, I don't know if he does, because, like, you know what I mean? Like, he's trying to... Like I said, if he is thinking right now that he's going to live and he's trying to get Rose to get on this lifeboat, knowing that if she gets on the lifeboat, obviously she's going to live. Yet he's playing it up as if this is going to be the last time he's ever going to see her. You know what I mean? It's kind of weird. Like, the way his voice is warbly, like, "They're almost full."
Yeah, it's very, I almost forgot about that line. That line is very performative.
Yeah.
That line is very much Billy Zane doing a good acting job of Cal performing.
Yeah, Cal does that a lot.
Yeah, but it's very performative, and he somehow thinks that she's still gonna fall for this crap. Like, I think this is the last scene. Obviously, like, the scene that we're talking about sort of ends with him just going off the rails, but I think this is, like, the last cool Cal that we see. After this, he's a madman. Yeah. You know, like, this is his last grasp of normalcy, or of thinking that this night might work out the way that he is going to try to orchestrate it.
He does have one moment where he kind of gets misty-eyed, though. Maybe in that moment he felt this is what, like, in when he was acting, like, maybe he just, his eyes welled up naturally, and maybe James Cameron just used it to, like, play on, like, the pathos of this character or something for the audience. But I also interpret it as this is a guy who's never really loved before, and maybe he's experiencing something and he doesn't know, like, what to do with it, and it's conflicting with all this, like, calculations and this, like, manipulation that he's done, and it's kind of seeping through, and that's maybe, I don't know, I'm probably reading way too into it, but, like,
I mean, I guess it's possible that maybe we're meant to think that Cal is having, you know, a cathartic you know, that maybe his feelings are chaotic and that he regrets maybe getting to this. But I don't know. I just don't. I guess it's in the realm of possibility. But to me, that Cal moment is very perform. I think I would put money on that Cameron, like, gave direction to Billy Zane in that moment of, you know, as Cal, you are trying to convince her that you care about, you know, this, and this. But really what you care about is separating her from Jack, getting her on that boat, and making sure that Jack goes down to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
True. And interesting, though. Okay. So Cal's line was originally a little bit different. So he had originally said to Rose, "There are boats on the other side that are allowing men in. Jack and I can get off safely, both of us," right? And then it says, there's an annotation that says that Cameron wanted to change it to make it more believable. And so that's why he changed it to be way more specific. Because according to Cameron, he says, a lie always works best when you're more specific. So he had Cal say, "I have an arrangement with an officer on the other side of the ship," like to make it a little bit more like...
So it sounded more believable. Mm-hmm. And it is believable because Rose does know that Cal just like buys his way into anything in this world. So I guess he probably thought, that's a good call on Cameron's part on editing on the script.
However, something I started thinking about in recent years is, why would Rose ever think that Cal would have an arrangement where both he and Jack could get off safely together?
I don't think she ever would have fallen. I mean, that's the thing. It's like Cal thinks she's going to fall for this stuff. But and maybe she does at first, because, I mean, you know, I was thinking about this scene like in prep for talking to you. I was thinking, OK, if I was in that situation and I was Rose, there's maybe a world in which I would think, we are in the middle of an actual trauma. So maybe this man who has shown obviously some very dark sides, and I don't want to be engaged to him anymore, but we're in this life or death trauma. So maybe he'll be an actual human being, put that aside, try to save everybody's life he can, and we'll deal with this later. Like, I guess there's a world in which Rose might have briefly thought, okay, like maybe because this is truly life or death, we're going to put problems aside and deal later. Like, maybe, you know, but then I think, and we'll get to it in a minute, but then when she jumps off of the lifeboat, it's because she realizes, no, that's not true. That's not going to happen. And I'm saying goodbye to someone. Cal's not going to, you know what I mean? I don't mean to jump ahead, but I think, yeah, I think that there is maybe a little whisper of her believing at the point we're talking about in the scene now, like that maybe Cal could help Jack out. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
Because that just seemed weird. I was like, yes, the man that I have been so angry with this whole time and that I've been trying to humiliate every chance I get and do not want you near. Yeah, I made an arrangement where we can both get off safely and we can continue this love triangle drama when we get to New York.
Pause the love. Yeah, now that I'm saying it, I'm like, yeah, let's pause the love triangle. But I mean, you know, I don't like, when you're in the middle of a true trauma, you know, because you do hear stories about people going through trauma together and sort of like burying hatchets, or like, you know, people that wouldn't normally get along or wouldn't normally agree with one another, like getting through a tragedy together, like the moment of trauma sometimes can do that. So I guess maybe we're supposed to believe that she had some amount of faith in that promise. I don't know. It's hard. The scene is very, this is a complex one to talk about. Yeah, there's a lot of motivations. Mm-hmm.
So Jack immediately plays along. Like, you can see Jack thinking as well. He like hears what Cal says and he's like, okay, so that's a lie.
Yeah, he already but
yeah, he knows. Yeah. Rose may not know, but he knows immediately.
That might be what convinces Rose, because Jack seems to buy into it. So she's like,
right.
Okay, well, that's true.
He has street smarts. Like, if he believes him, then like it's probably fine. Yeah.
Then, true. Like, maybe. Yep. Yeah.
See, there's always one thing that comes after the other where then I'm like, oh, wait, never mind. Yeah, because he says, see, I got my own boat to catch. And she's like, you can see her thinking. She's like, oh, okay, then, I guess. So now Jack is urging me to get on and agreeing with Cal. So sure, I guess. So Rose starts to board the lifeboat. And I just put a note that this was the first time I ever noticed that father saying to the daughters, you're my little sailor. Or like he says that to one of the daughters, you're my little sailor. I never caught that before until listening with headphones, taking my notes. I was like, oh.
I think I might have caught it when it was in the theaters again. I think there are a lot of little lines like that I caught in the theater this time around that I haven't noticed in years or maybe ever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of them. Yeah.
Can always find something new. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just as small as this little line you never heard before. So Rose sits down in the lifeboat. They start to lower it. And the incredible score kicks in. That little lone flute or whatever instrument that is.
So good.
That little lone wind instrument. starts to set the tone. So great. And Cal immediately breaks the facade up there as he's standing there with Jack and just says,
"You're a good liar.
Even away.
Almost as good as you.
Easy now. And lower away.
There's no arrangement, is there?
Lower away.
No, there is.
Even.
Not that you'll benefit much from it.
And even away.
I always win, Jack.
And lower away evenly, lads.
One way or another.
What's that trim?
You know, Cal's basically telling Jack right then, well, so you're gonna die. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like bye.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I was about to say, I saw you get the script out. The script is different.
He was originally going to say it's a pity I didn't keep that drawing, it'll be worth a lot more by morning line.
Oh, wow.
To Jack's face.
Huh. Interesting.
Wild. It's wild. Yeah. Is there a note about why he changed it?
I don't think there's a... It just says they moved the line. It doesn't say...
Yeah, could you imagine, like, having, I don't know, the gall to say that to someone's face? Like, yeah. You're going to die.
Like, that almost would have put blood on Cal's hands, in a way.
Yeah, like, you're going to die, so I wish I would have kept your drawing so I could sell it, or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and not that he actually would have, but just can you imagine saying that to somebody's face?
Yeah. Insane.
That's gross.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely works better earlier. Also, it pushes her to like,
yeah,
make.
Yeah, it works where he moved it. That's got to be one of his most perfect like script
yeah.
edits.
Yeah,
like, that's a good move
because like it actually serves a purpose in with Rose, whereas here it's just Cal being a jerk.
Yeah.
And insulting this man to his face for no good reason other than I'm evil.
Yeah, like you're probably gonna die with the masses of people in the water, and let me also make you just feel terrible emotionally too before that even happens. Like, you know, like let me go ahead and put more horrible images in your head as you prepare to die with people in the water.
Yep.
And yeah, that's pretty brutal.
Yep. Very evil. So then he says what pretty much confirms everything we've been speculating, where he says, I always win, Jack, one way or another.
When he says one way or another, in my head, I saw it as like, I can't have her, neither can you type of thing. Like, so.
Because like I said earlier, he basically is thinking that both him and Rose are going to survive.
Yeah. He thinks he's going to put this coat on her. She's going to get in the boat. He's going to go get in his boat.
And Jack's going to die. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's like, even if I don't get with her, you still aren't going to get with her, basically. Like, I think he knows that he's not going to be with her after this, like, whatever happens.
No, but he's going to win because Jack will not be alive to experience what he wants with Rose. Like, he's that vitriolic, he's that evil, that all that matters is making sure this other person doesn't get what he wants. The ultimate, like, loss is that you were going to lose your life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The ultimate loss, yeah.
Yeah, my goodness. that got dark. Let's move on.
Oh, and something I put in my notes as well about this, because I had written, there's a lot to unpack in this, which we have been doing.
That's what I said. Yeah, I said that exact phrase like 10 minutes ago. Yeah.
But there's even more. So in my notes about this line with the I always win one way or another, and then the way it hangs on Jack's reaction for a little bit, and he's kind of taking that in, I said, this is also a little bit of upper class beating lower class. It's Jack thinking about his circumstances and how this is his situation just because of whatever, you know, that this is everything in his life has led to this. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you guys have talked a lot about it over many scenes, like the class dynamics. I think Cameron does such a good job of weaving those into every scene. So, or not every scene, but every part of the movie. And so I think you're right. I think it's another reminder of first class versus third class, like standing there together. And I mean, you know, James Cameron always said his driving force when he was writing the script was, you know, who was the least likely to survive statistically was a third class male, who was the most likely to survive that night statistically was a first class woman. So put them together, you know, I mean, he said in so many interviews that that was the driving force behind writing that script the way that it was. So I think he was thinking about class the whole time was writing every single scene in the film. And yeah, I think you can you could do, like, a historian could do, like, a class analysis of almost every scene of the movie.
Yes.
And you could look at it just through that lens and have a lot of material.
It's like Shakespearean, right?
Oh, yeah. Like for Romeo, absolutely. And Juliet, yeah.
And, yeah.
So I said that Jack just kind of puts on a brave face, I guess. He knows that this is likely going to be the last time he will ever see Rose. Like, he knows this now. So he's just taking it in. He's saying goodbye to her with his eyes, pretty much, you know.
And the music, too, is great here because it starts out you wanting you to think that, I think. And then, obviously, it, like, evolves later in the scene to, like, a different tone. But, yeah, mm-hmm. The music here is this the first time we've heard this motif in a while in the movie? It's the first time in like an hour or over an hour that we've heard it, I think.
Probably.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but that's a good point. It might be.
That's why it hits so much harder.
Yeah. He saves it. Yeah. And this is, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect moment.
Oh, yeah. I had also written in my notes that Jack being brought down to reality again and realizing that everything that's happened was too good to be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's harsh, but true. I mean, it's the whirlwind of, you know, I mean, it's like the criticism of the movie by a lot of people, but I, of course, don't criticize it for this. And you guys, I know, don't either. Mm-hmm. The whirlwind nature of their romance is so beautiful. But it's moments like these in the movie where you do stop and calculate, oh, like they've only known each other this long, or they've been on this high of falling in love this fast. And then suddenly this ship is sinking from under them. Yeah, I mean, that I think that's some of Leo's best acting in this scene mm-hmm. in the movie, which I can't even. Mm-hmm. I'm the Leo person. I should have said that already. I don't know why I'm not. Well, I'm saving my Leo for what's coming. But I think probably some of his best acting in the movie is in this portion of the scene with him and Cal over the railing.
And she's for sure. And Rose is always like ahead of him. At the beginning of the movie, she's already on the ship before he's on it. And like he's handcuffed down below. She's already above and she has to come back. And then here she's already on the lifeboat. She has to come back.
Yeah.
And like, and it's kind of funny because in like the first half of the movie, he's kind of coming to her every time. And now she's like coming back for him every time.
That's actually a really good point. I had never thought about that.
Yeah, like he's always seeking her out a little bit.
Yeah, and then she's like coming back for him. It's just and it again, it's like the two opposite classes, and then it's balanced the first half, and then it's kind of flipped mm-hmm. for the second half. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just James Cameron's mastery, but
masterclass. Yeah. Absolutely.
So as Rose is descending in the lifeboat, I wrote a little note that she has that super intense eyebrow going on, which I've always noticed. Our left, her right eyebrow is just, it's going to town. It's just, it's up there. It's just, it's not moving.
I've always noticed that too. Yeah. Yes, I've always noticed that. And talk about acting, I think. Okay, I think I have heard James Cameron talk about her acting in this scene before. I can't remember what interview or if it was the commentary, but her acting is like, everything you need is in her face. Mm-hmm. Like you don't need any dialogue from her. The way she is able to convey the emotional journey from getting on the boat, you know, with hesitancy mm-hmm. to sitting on the boat for a few seconds, watching him from above, watching both of them, and then starting that thought process of getting off of the lifeboat. You see it all in her face. I bet you even if you took the music out of that scene,
oh, yeah.
you would still get everything you need from her face. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think both Leo and Kate Winslet, I think they're at their best when they're like with their facial expressions. And I think James Cameron traditionally, historically, casts in that way. If you look at all his movies, the actors he casts are really good facial actors. Even like Linda Hamilton in like Terminator, like she was a great facial actor. Even like Arnold's a pretty good facial actor.
I was about to say Arnold is largely a facial actor.
Like let's be real, Arnold's not a
to put it nicely.
Yeah. No shade to Arnold.
So I think Cameron just likes facial actors.
I think so. I think he, and I think when he screened, just from like little snippets that I've heard, I think when he screen tests people, it's all about the face, you know? It's like when he talks about Kate Winslet's screen test, you know, at some point he said in an interview, I saw her on camera and I couldn't find a bad angle on her face, you know, and it's yeah. And that's what got her the part. And I mean, obviously she's stunningly beautiful, but I think apart from that, I think she does such great facial acting that, yeah, he probably couldn't find a bad. I think she probably went in, even in the screen test, just doing exactly what he asked for.
Yeah, I never really thought about it until we were talking about it just now. But yeah, speaking of his decision making in this scene, too. The whole time Rose is descending, we don't just do like a shot, reverse shot thing on like her and Jack. Like it's always Jack, Cal, and in the frame. Like we see both of them as she's coming down and she's yes. looking up at both of them. It's emboldening my argument for like that Cal has like some sort of emotional attachment, because I don't know, to me, why would they keep showing him and like make a point to do that?
Well, that's interesting, because I did write something about that in my notes. I said, firstly, quickly as well, what also makes the scene powerful is that we're seeing it from Rose's perspective in many in many cuts. Mm-hmm. She's looking at the davits shaking. She's looking at the children next to her waving goodbye to their father. She's looking at the officer lowering the ship, all in slow motion, so it's that much more effective. Puts you there as well. I said this is like another reason why this movie is so experiential. The way people say like you experience Titanic, you don't just like watch it. It's like that's mm-hmm. one of those little things that does that. Suddenly, like, we're Rose in those few moments, which makes everything so much more heightened. But yeah, so I said both Cal and Jack are looking down at her. I said, but we know that she's really only looking at Jack, I feel like.
And then it does, like, zoom in on him with the lights above. Yeah.
But then I said, but with that shot of the two of them, it does almost feel like she's saying goodbye to both possible lives she could have lived. That's what I wrote in my notes.
Well, it's a decision. I mean, and with what she's about to do, what we're about to talk about, she's making a decision. I mean, she is. She's looking at both options and both versions of her life. And you can, like I said, you can see the whole thought process on her face. And she, and then she makes, obviously, a very big decision. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Do you guys remember when you first watched this? Did people go into the, while they're watching this movie, did they just assume Jack was going to die? Based off maybe like the framing story with Old Rose and stuff? I don't remember what I thought originally.
Yeah, like obviously I didn't see it in theater, so you probably have a different memory of this, LA. But I know from like what my mom always told me, because back then this was like a time when you could easily avoid spoilers if you wanted to. And mom always told me that everyone that had talked to her about Titanic and like told her to go see it, they didn't give anything away. They didn't want to give anything away.
See, and that is so amazing, because everyone gives movies away now, and also trailers give the whole freaking plot of the movie away. I hate watching trailers.
And so she said it was everyone. It was one of those movies, though, right? That it's an experience. And so everybody back then didn't want to rob anybody of that experience.
Yes.
And so they told you like, oh, you just got to see it. You have to see it. I can't tell you anything. You just have to see it. Yeah. I feel like a lot of people probably went in not knowing what Jack's fate was, because I always thought as well, yes, we know that Rose is alive, but we also see that she has a granddaughter, and we also see that, you know, she's telling this story, and, you know, maybe at the end they'll tell us like, oh, you know, she was pregnant with Jack's kid that whole time or something. And then
that's what launched 1,000 fan fictions, guys, in 1998. I wrote some of them. Yeah. So I remember thinking the first time I saw it, when they tell you that her name, when they say in the framing story, when they say her name was Rose Dawson back then.
Yep. That's
right, so I thought, I remember, and I was, you know, 13, what did I know about life? But I remember thinking, oh no, I bet they
got married.
They end up and get married, but then he like dies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like because then they say she marries this guy named Cal. So I was thinking like, oh no. I was thinking he didn't die on Titanic.
Exactly.
That he would die. But then again, at that point, I didn't really know who Jack was. I didn't know how invested I was going to be in it. I hadn't seen the rest of the movie yet. So it didn't mean much yet. But I do think it's interesting that he gives so much of that away at the beginning of the movie, but he's a genius in doing that in many ways as well. And then I also remember thinking that there was going to be the reveal that Lizzie was his granddaughter. Mm-hmm. Like I kept thinking the first time I saw it towards the end, I remember thinking she's blonde, she's about the right age. I bet that she's actually, we're going to find out that she had like a pregnancy and that this is Jack's granddaughter. Yep. I so wanted it to be true and was devastated. I don't know. But that, well, how weird is it that at 13 I was sitting in the movie chair like thinking that? But, yeah. I don't know. But that's how I like wanted the movie to end.
Because it is a twist. Like it is a, it's not a, like a neck breaking twist, but it is a twist. Yeah. Like you don't know. You,
like it could have been fun to do that.
Yeah. Well, you, yeah, you are, he wants you to think that this is, that he made, that he survived based off the name and stuff too. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wants you to be confused.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, in the fan fiction community, there are so, there, I mean, I'm not really in, I'm not in it now at all, but there were so many stories were like, Lizzie is Jack's granddaughter, or like, I would say like every third story was like, oh, well, Rose was actually pregnant, and then here's what happened, or Jack just doesn't die. I mean, and that's like most of them are Jack doesn't die, like just completely rewriting everything so that we can get more Leo, basically.
Yep.
But I always tell my husband that if I could time travel to 1997 and like see it for the first time again and relive those feelings, I would love to be able to just pop back into that moment.
Yeah. I would love to see Star Wars on its first, like Empire Strike or Return of the Jedi.
Here we go. Star Wars mention of the day as well. And I have, and in my notes, I have another Star Wars mention for a little bit later.
There we go. Scene. We're covered.
Yep. So also on the commentary, as we see those shots from Rose's perspective, James Cameron said that this was going into Rose's mind and filmed in slow motion to highlight the musical score. And I guess going into the scene, he knew he wanted to make this a, quote, musical moment. So they did a lot of things with the scene to highlight the score. I think it was the sound designer, like one of the guys who worked on sound, said that they made a point to do that. They removed any unimportant sounds so that you could just focus on the music and Kate's breathing, some of the stuff in slow motion that we can hear. She's looking at Jack now. They've zoomed in on Jack, so we know for sure she's looking at Jack. She's not looking at Cal. And Jack is very emotional in this moment, which is also very sweet. You know what I mean? Like, he has tears in his eyes. Mm-hmm. You can tell that
he does.
His nose is getting a little runny because of the way he's breathing as well, you know? His nostrils are flaring. That's my Boston accent right there. His nostrils are flaring.
We gotta talk about The Departed.
Yeah, let me bring my mom in here. Then you can really hear it.
One of my favorite movies of all time.
Then as she's looking at him, that flare goes off in the background, which apparently was a happy accident, I guess.
Oh, really?
And I guess it was written in,
I read this.
Yeah. It was written in the script, though, that like, oh, like a flare goes off behind him. So I guess Cameron said that they were hoping for that, like that they could maybe catch that. And he goes, but you had no idea where those things were going to fly off to, I guess.
Because you're so zoomed in and it's like there's not a lot of space for it to catch right there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was kind of perfect.
But what's interesting, too, though, is that that shot is also a little bit out of focus. It's a little bit out of focus on Jack. Like, it's slightly blurry.
That's another one where they just, but he, it's like the bow scene, right? It's like, it's a little out of focus, but it's the
perfect
shot, and so it's in.
You gotta keep it. You have to keep it in. It kind of works as well with, like, from Rose's perspective, because, like, what if she had tears in her eyes or something? It might look like that.
Yeah, it's like a blurry, teary-eyed, and Leo's face in that moment, again, he's doing, I think, some of his best acting in the movie in this scene. He's totally selling. I mean, he is selling it 100% that he is looking one last time at this person that he has fallen in love with and that has sort of become his whole world for the last few days. And he's heartbroken, but he's staying strong and he's trying to give off this very stoic.
He's smiling at her through the tears as well, too, a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. He's doing the same thing the dad was doing for his kids. You know, he's putting on the brave face, even though his heart is breaking inside.
Mm-hmm. This is almost like a second light bulb moment as well, where a flare happens to go off. So like that first one was the unimaginable bastard moment.
That's right. Yeah, I never thought about that.
Right, it illuminated Rose's face in that moment where she's like, hey, whoa, no, I'm leaving. And now it's kind of the same thing accidentally, I guess. This flare goes off and we see it illuminate her face just before she makes this crazy decision, you know. And I also just said that the flare and everything like that just makes Jack look so much more dreamy too. He's just very, he's just, oh God. I mean, he's just, yeah. Who wouldn't jump back onto Titanic?
I wouldn't. I would, for Leo, I would probably jump back on a sinking ship. I'd be like, you know, we've got a shot. We could maybe make it, so.
Funnily enough, I guess on the historical commentary, they had mentioned that there was like a group of women were polled about this, like asking if they would jump back on the ship. And most of the under 25s said that they would. And all of the older women were like, heck no, I'm not jumping back on that ship.
I have two kids I've got to get home to. So realistically, no. But if I could go back and be like my like 20-year-old self, then like, yeah, I probably would do it for him.
I want them to ask kids. Who would have even gotten on the lifeboat to begin with? Who would have been even better than Rose?
True.
He's not gotten
on. Oh, yeah.
He's like, nope.
Yeah, except as we talked about, she'd gotten on and stayed on.
I know.
Jackman.
That's what's here next in my notes. So I say, Rose makes the rash decision to jump back on to Titanic. And I said, this is a slightly controversial choice that she makes here because there's a lot of speculation about whether or not Rose just stayed on the lifeboat, that Jack would have been able to find that piece of driftwood himself and he would have survived himself. And then they could have found each other somehow and just ran off and been together and everything was fine.
Because now there's an empty seat on a lifeboat because she left it. So someone else could have been saved.
I always feel bad about that, too.
Yeah, that's true. What about that dad? The dad. I can't do. Oh no!
Thing, right? Like there are so many people who try to say that Rose is the real villain, and I always hate when they say that. But then you take a scene like this, and when you break it down, when you look at it, it's like this was kind of a selfish thing to do in the moment. You know?
I mean, a little bit. I have so a friend, and he's a friend now, but there's a historian named Gareth Russell who wrote this book called Ship of Dreams, which is truly one of the best Titanic books ever written, and it's very academic, and his research is impeccable. He's been on my pod, and we've kind of become friends. He's great, but he is the most anti-Rose person. He's written me whole messages on Instagram. They're like, and this, and the bellboy in the elevator, and this, and he cannot stand her. So we've had to just, you know, agree to disagree, and like we've decided to be friends, even though we disagree about this core thing. But there is a contingency out there of that Rose is the villain. I'm not. I will never give any credence to that. But yeah,
no.
Some people, if someone was in that camp, they could use this scene to illustrate that.
Exactly.
So something funny was on the commentary, James Cameron said, I guarantee you that nobody was jumping from a lifeboat back onto Titanic except for in our story.
No, there was one, and it's in the movie too. There was like a recorded incident of a woman like falling and then being put back on.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, you know, definitely nobody purposely was trying to get back once they'd gotten on a lifeboat, I would say.
Rose makes the decision. She jumps on. She's hanging off the side of the ship. People pull her back on. And Jack, you know, immediately starts, you know, yelling after her, saying like, Rose, no, like, what are you doing? Cal doesn't do anything, first of all. All he does is say, stop her.
Like his minion, like these people on the ship are just going to be his minions.
And like the way he says stop her just twice in a very similar inflection, that's it. That's the extent of work he's doing to help save her. And then we know that he didn't exactly go running after her either, because he's just kind of standing there when we see him later. Yeah. He probably just made his way there leisurely.
He moseyed to the staircase.
Yep. And also, so Jack immediately goes to run and meet up to wherever he thinks she's heading. And I said, I don't know how they both knew where to run to meet. But I mean, I guess maybe
meet me at the clock.
There you go. That too. Yeah. But always maybe they knew, you know, if she came on that way, the one way she'd be able to get near here would be to go.
Well, then also, like, they're in the middle of all of this chaos, so it's definitely plausible that at some point in the scenes prior, in, like, you know, in part that we, like, quote-unquote, didn't see, mm-hmm. even though, you know, those parts don't exist, that, like, maybe they would have made a plan, like, you know, this is chaotic, so if we get separated, let's try to meet here or something. I mean, who knows? You know, I guess you could believe that that's possible, too.
Oh, that's cute. I like that.
You probably would in that scenario. I would, because I'm clumsy. And I am terrible in crowds and chaos. So I would need like plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D. But how I've always interpreted is just like an instinctive, this is where we would go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right as they're about to, you know, reunite again. You know, I wrote a note that I love Leo's stressed face as he makes his way into the first class area. And he is
like, I have got to get to my woman.
Yep.
He cannot handle the fact that she has put herself in danger again. He is like, he throws the blanket. Again, some of his best acting of the movie, but he has got to get to her. His only job in the whole world is to get to her.
Mm-hmm. The pushing through people on the deck, like the intensity of it. And then when he makes his way into that area and he's like, he stops running and does a brisk little power walk for a minute. And like,
yeah, he does power walk. It's really weird.
And when he does the power walk, he has that face. He's like,
this is where I'll give my Leo speech.
Oh, God.
So that it's not that long. I have a lot of them, but I'll give you a short one. The first time that my husband ever watched the movie with me, I think it was the first time ever we like sat down and really watched it from beginning to end together. So this was, I don't know, probably 10 years ago at this point. When this scene comes on and Leo comes down the staircase and they come together and he starts saying, "You're so stupid." My husband turns to me and he said, "That's it. That's what got you when you were 13, right?" And I said, "Yes, this is the scene. This is the scene that got me when I was 13 that made me fall in love." Like him rushing down that staircase and telling her, "She's so stupid. What did you do?" All while he's like kissing her face and communicating with every word and every movement of his body that she is the most important thing to him in the whole world. Hook, line, and sinker. Like Leo in that moment, that is what sold me on him. That is what I was in love. I was done for. And it's so funny just that my husband knew me that well to know like that was the moment. And that interaction right there is just, I mean, I obviously want to love to hear what you guys think. For me, the standout of that moment when they like come back together is just the intimacy of it, like the intimacy that they have been able to achieve after just a few days of knowing one another. Like the way that they come together in that moment is way more indicative of like a couple that's been together for years.
Yeah.
Their interactions and their kisses and their embrace is so natural and organic and frenzied. Like you would think those people have been married for 10 years, you know, or 20 years. So that's how you would interact. Like, listen, that's what I mean about seeming like they've been together longer. If my husband and I were in that scenario, and I had gotten back the ship, he would have been so mad.
Yeah.
But he...
because he cares that much.
Yes. Like he would have... And that's exactly what that scene would have looked like. Just, you are so dumb and stupid. Why did you do that? But we have to go through this together and we love each other. You know, like that... It played out exactly like it would have played out with people that have a much longer history together.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's really one of the most important moments in the whole movie.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's underrated as in terms of a moment in the movie, like a Jack Rose moment in the movie, because everyone talks about the bow scene, everyone talks about the car scene, but that's, to me, that may be the most important Jack Rose moment.
I mean, I think it's definitely a big fan favorite, I think, though. Something about it, too, the way you said it's like a really important, one of the most important moments for them in the movie. If we're trying to sell that, you know, Rose would live her entire life still thinking of Jack until the day she dies, you know what I mean? Like a scene like this to show how in sync they really were with each other and how, like you said, they already seemed like they were a couple that had been together for years, that, you know, that's how she had felt about him. Like, yeah, it was only 3 days or 2 days, whatever, but look at how close we became in that time, you know.
And it's supposed to be too, like, from her perspective.
But yeah, some of what you said, yeah, is what James Cameron said on the commentary. He said, you know, Jack's calling her stupid, even though she's the most important person in the world to him. James Cameron loves how Leo was playing multiple things in this scene very beautifully, he said. So he, you know, knows that she loves him as much as he loves her. And so because of that, he's very happy in this moment. He's glad to see her again, that they're going to have more time together. But at the same time, he knows that this is pretty much a death sentence for the both of them. That's what James Cameron said. So that's like where the "you're stupid" thing is coming from. And the way he's saying it is also just very raw. Like he's almost losing his voice, you know, so yeah. And he said he thinks it's some of Leo's best work.
And also, like, you could even argue that Jack might have died anyway, because Cal would have been more involved in his fate. He ended up getting more time with Rose, whereas before he might not have ever seen her again.
That's true.
And if he ended up dying at Cal's hands or whatever Cal was planning,
which is definitely, as we're about to talk about, yeah, definitely possible. Yeah. I mean, there's a world in which both of them just die at Cal's hand. Mm-hmm. There's an alternate, you know, just in the realm of what the branches on the tree of this story, there's like an alternate universe, mm-hmm, where the Cal's gun just like ends it for the both of them.
Doesn't hit the banister or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, of course, to wrap up this very powerful moment between the two of them, he goes, "Why did you do that? Why?" And she says, "You jump, I jump, right?" In a very old Hollywood line reading again, which we always comment on. She has that old flair to that. The "you jump, I jump, right?" It's very wistful.
It's very 1940s.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
Love it. And he just says, "Right." He's like, "Oh, right. You're remembering all of this."
And that's a very beautiful moment on his part too, because he's kind of shocked that she's remembering and throwing that back at him. And like, he's very flattered and I think amazed in that moment that he's realizing that she really does love him that much.
Yeah. It's totally reciprocated now. Like, it's the same level.
Yeah. You can see that on his face wash over him, mm-hmm, that he's sort of like, "Oh wow,
like he's relieved,
you're right, oh yeah, right, oh yeah, right," you know. And I think again, it's like, it's why it's such an important Jack and Rose moment. Like, this is the moment where it's like, we are, you know, if this means that we drown in an hour, but this is, we are each other's people, mm-hmm, you know. This is, nothing's going to change that at this point,
right? And I think Cal knows this. But yeah, of course, the saying "you jump, I jump" is, of course, a payoff to past scenes. Of course, a big setup payoff as well to both the suicide scene and the gym scene, when Jack reminds her, "You jump, I jump, I can't turn away without knowing you'll be all right." That's what's happening here. Like, Rose couldn't really turn away, get on that lifeboat knowing that he might die. Like, she's like, I gotta be with him. I don't care. Gotta do it. So we hear Rose tell him, "I couldn't go, Jack." Like, you can hear their voices as it zooms in on Cal overseeing them up on the staircase. Mm-hmm. And he's just in disbelief, holding on to the banister, like, "What is happening? This can't happen." Jack pulled that reverse Uno card or whatever, right?
Yeah, he did.
So Rose, also, we hear her say, "At least I'm with you," which, mm-hmm, I had never made that out before until a couple years ago. I don't know what I thought she was saying as a kid. I always heard, like, "Please stay with you," something with you.
I think I heard it as a kid. I think I heard it as, I'll stay with you. I don't know. I didn't hear "at least I'm with you." I heard "I'll stay with you," maybe. I don't know. But it wasn't until I rewatched it in the last few years that I picked up on. I think as an adult, you just, I know I'm just way more aware of, mm-hmm, dialogue than I would have been as a kid. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. But yeah, she, you know, and it's like, we've already seen that on their faces, but that line of dialogue kind of sums up everything we just said about this scene, which is, that's what they're communicating to each other, is that, "Oh, well, at least we're together. Like, yep, you know, this is going to be horrible, but at least we're together."
And that's, like, so sweet. And she, like, laughs when she says it too. She's like, "At least, mm-hmm, I'm with you."
Yeah. I mean, they're scared, but they're not, it's almost as if they're less scared when they're together.
Mm-hmm. And then I love the way Jack says, it's all right, we'll think of something. I'm like, he's the best.
Yeah, I know. It's such a good line.
It is a good line.
Jack is smart, but he's also so simple.
I know. Yeah.
That's the beauty of Jack. Yeah. Like, he's like, we'll think of something. You know, and there's like a beauty in the simplicity of how that character thinks about things, mm-hmm. which serves them well in a lot of the scenarios. But
like we say, he's a glass half full guy to the very end.
Yeah, he is. Poor Jack.
Yeah, so I said Cal, he oversees this moment and he just begins to see red. And this is more support, of course, that it's really just the fact that Jack is gonna win that was driving him. And now it's driving him insane. We see Lovejoy try to pull Cal away from the situation. And again, going back to everything we've been talking about Lovejoy and his hatred for Jack, again, this is a moment where Lovejoy's like, all right, Cal, bro, she does not love you. It is time to move on. Let's go.
Lovejoy in this moment is basically like, can we go try to save our own flipping lives? To Lovejoy's credit, in this moment, he is like, let's be done with this.
Yeah.
Like, let's let it go. And Cal is not ready to.
No, and again, like I was saying in our last episodes when we've been trying to talk about like why Lovejoy hates Jack so much, how he just wants to be done with Jack. Like, you could interpret this as another moment. Like, nah, this is our chance. Like, I am getting away from this kid at all costs. I hate him for whatever reason. And you are not going to reinsert yourself. And then, of course, what does Cal do? He reaches in for Lovejoy's gun, and Lovejoy's just left to stand there once again. Here we go again.
Yeah, and he's like, and you know this is after years of having to deal with Cal's just crap.
Nonsense.
You know what I mean? Like, this is, like, Lovejoy's probably nearing retirement. Like, he's probably been on this guy for years, having to pull him out of the bars and the hotels and the sleazy spots, as we know from deleted scenes earlier in the movie. And he's probably just, he's done. Like, for all we know, he is retiring after this crossing and gonna take money from Cal's dad and go live in a house by the beach. He seems like so over it in many ways. Mm-hmm. But it's also a callback, you know, the gun being there is a classic James Cameron callback to the, you know, I make my own luck, so do I, with the gun. So, like, it's just another, y'all talk about this a lot, I know, but just another example of a callback, which he does, you know, 50 times in this movie seamlessly.
So. Which we don't even realize, right? Like, because if he didn't put that in there to have Lovejoy show us where he was keeping his gun, it would have been like, how did Cal know to just reach into his coat and grab a gun?
You had to know that Cal knew in the back of his mind, that's there, I can grab that if I need it.
It's a Chekhov's gun. Yeah. So, like, the rule is you can't use a gun in the third act unless you've shown it, you know, in the first or second act, and you can't show a gun early on if you're not going to use it later. Like, it's basically, it's like a big no-no if you just pull out a gun and it was never seen earlier, or vice versa. Or you show a gun.
It would have been really crazy if he just pulled this gun from Lovejoy. Because, then we would have been distracted by that in the scene.
Yeah.
We would have, our brains would have been, wait, where did that come from or what? Yeah, and then it would distract from what essentially then becomes a chase sequence.
Yeah. Yes. So in the screenplay, it pretty much also solidifies that this was really just about a Cal versus Jack thing. It says, quote, Cal sees her jump. She is willing to die for this man, this gutter scum. He is overwhelmed by rage, so all-consuming it eclipses all thought. So he just hates Jack. He just hates the whole concept of the fact that this guy is somehow going to beat him, this gutter scum, you know?
He hates the concept of Jack.
Yeah, he just everything about him.
I'm going to start calling people gutter scum.
Let's bring it back.
When I'm mad. Yeah, when I'm mad at people, you gutter scum. It's such a weird term.
Yes. Cal, as he grabs Lovejoy's gun, he does, it cuts to slow motion, first of all, so it gets very over the top. He does a dramatic, like, James Bond kind of swerve, and he's, like, holding the gun while doing the pouting face. What is the pouting face? Where he's, like...
There is, like, some Zoolander, which...
Yes!
Sully Zane has been in Zoolander, but there is, like, some... There is some Zoolander stuff going on there. It's, like, Billy Zane is, like, this is my moment. This is my sexy face. Like, I don't... But something is happening in that moment. Billy Zane thinks, I mean, it is an action movie, but that is definitely the moment Billy Zane is on set and he says to himself, this is an action movie and this is my moment. Mm-hmm. And so he is like cocking that guy. I mean, it really is. It's like a James Bond moment. And Billy Zane is going for it. And I give full credit. I think you guys mentioned this on an episode recently, but I think people used to view it as bad acting, mm-hmm. but there's been a revival of people revisiting that performance and realizing that he's doing like old Hollywood villain so perfectly that it's actually a really great performance.
I agree. I like performances where I can't imagine it done another, or I can't imagine someone else doing it that way. And mm-hmm. I can't imagine anybody else delivering Cal in this exact way, and so that's what makes it fun.
There's no one else that could have done Cal this way.
So it is transitioning into straight up action movie here. James Cameron had said that it is hard to strike the right balance of tone because a lot of test audiences did not like this turn and like where it was going, because they thought that, you know, the real drama of the sinking of the Titanic was enough. Like, he had already pulled them in so much to all of the tragedy going on that this guy suddenly chasing them with a gun was like, okay, this is too much. Like, we don't need this.
Yeah, and I'm sure you guys will talk about it in the next scene. I won't be here for that, but like, there's so much that was shot mm-hmm. on top of this that gets caught for that very reason. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if have you read the book The Making of James Cameron? Have you read that one?
No, but I have heard of it. Yeah,
there's a great segment where the woman who wrote the book, I think, was on site for some of these screenings because she followed him around through some of this part of his life. And there's a great like 4 or 5 pages about those screenings at the Mall of America in 97, where people are, you know, writing on their comment cards about the chase scene, and this is too much. I mean, people were very vehemently against it, mm-hmm. and I think he really had no choice but to cut that out. And I think, anyway, you guys will talk about it in your next scene, but it is wild to think that there's so much more that was supposed to come after this, too.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, too, though, right? Because he had no choice but to keep this bit with Cal in, though. He had no choice.
No, he had to keep this part. He had to keep this part, yeah.
They had to get back down into the ship, so it's like he had no choice but to keep this.
The other stuff that's coming, he could do that. But this part, there was no way to take this out and the movie be seamless still.
Yeah, so no matter what, we still had to deal with the minute-long gun chase.
Oh my gosh. And now it is kind of uninteresting, because at this point, it's like Jack and Rose are not going to die at this point in the movie.
Yeah. Could you imagine?
They died.
That's a different movie.
They died on the Titanic, but not because of the Titanic.
That's an R-rated movie, too. Like, Jack and Rose go down with, like, a gunshot to the head by Cal. That's
oh my God.
That's an R-rated movie. So there's, you know, so you, like, at that point, I think in your head... Sorry.
I'm just saying, like, could you imagine if right in this scene, Cal takes that first shot, and instead of shooting the end of the banister, he shot Jack point blank. The movie's over.
It's over.
Roll credits.
That's what I mean. Like, it would have been really powerful, but that's a different movie. Yeah. That's a different vibe. But I think as you're watching this movie, even for someone watching it the first time, in this scene, the chase is a little uninteresting because you know, worst case, he's going to like get one of them in the leg or the arm. Mm-hmm. And then that's going to make it harder for them, an obstacle. And so you're thinking like maybe, but mostly you're thinking like there's no way. There's still so much time left. Mm-hmm. The ship has not sunk. We're going to stay with Jack and Rose. There's no way they're dying right now. Right. So the stakes are just weird. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
But we do get the great Cal line that I'm sure you're about to
Yep. So, well, first of all, though, I did say the fact that Cal is shooting not just like at Jack, but he's just shooting randomly at both of them. He could murder Rose right now.
He's shooting at Rose too. Like, he has given, he's an animal now.
Yeah, he's on tilt.
Yeah, he's given up all normalcy, all sense of decency, or, I mean, he's gone wild, and he could end up shooting this person that he claimed a few hours earlier that he loved. So he's far gone. Yeah. This is off the rocker.
Because mm-hmm. I've seen people say, they're like, did Cal love Rose and stuff? And they're like, well, considering that he like almost literally murdered her by shooting her, like, I mean.
Yeah, probably not. I know, it's not my definition of love. Yeah.
Don't, like, good point.
Like, he slaps her,
yep,
verbally abuses her, then literally tries to shoot her.
This is just the cherry on top of all that.
So I'm going to say no on that one.
Yeah. So I did say, yeah, so Jack and Rose just keep running lower down this staircase, which is, you know, just putting them back to where they just worked so hard to get out of, which is a, you know, I've seen people express a little bit of frustration about that, because it's like, okay, you just got out, now we're going all the way back down, and then we're going to have to find a way out again. But I thought to myself, but like, where else would they run? Because are they going to run out onto the deck? And then where do they go?
You have limited space, yeah.
You know, are they going to run down a hallway? But then where do they go? But yeah, so there's really nowhere else that they could have run, because if they run out onto the deck, Cal's just shooting everywhere and there's a ton of people around. You know what I mean? That's just not...
It's not going to work.
It's terrible, you know?
No, that's another movie.
Yeah, that's...
There's so many movies baked in. So, of course, though, I did mention it is such a great touch how he slips on the part of the banister that he shot off. Yeah. Like, immediately he slips on it. I'm like, instant karma. And so, yeah, so they just keep heading further and further down the stairs, and we get those great shots right down the middle of the staircase where we can see the water coming in on the bottom floor there.
Yeah, that's a really cool shot, yeah.
And it's apparently based on one of Ken Marshall's paintings. It's another one of his paintings that James Cameron gave a nod to in the movie, and on the historical commentary he pointed that out, and that it was something that he kind of really wanted James Cameron to include. He kind of was like, I want to kind of include that moment, and he was happy to see it make it in. And then a lot of the other paintings that Cameron had recreated were a bit of a surprise for him as well. He didn't really know that, you know, these were some shots that James Cameron was doing. And so then when he finally saw it, he was like, oh my gosh, like, these are literally my paintings come to life. That's cool. That's cool. So that's so sweet.
There's also, I don't know if you guys saw the new Avatar movie. There's a sequence in there that reminded me of this, where, like,
I was going to say, there's a lot of the back end of the new Avatar that...
There's a lot of Titanic in there. Yeah,
there's a lot of Titanic.
It's Titanic on Pandora for the last, like, 30 minutes. So.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, if there's definitely a time where they're, like, could have left, but then they had to go back and get someone. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's, like, going into this back on the sinking ship. Yeah, it was very, very much similar to this.
If you guys are ever looking for, like, if you are done with scenes and you ever do, like, more content, that would be a great episode to do, like, a watch along of Avatar and talk about all the Titanic.
Yeah.
Because
that'd be a good idea.
It's pretty.
I'd be down.
I've been coming up. Since I know we're, like, running out of time, I'm already thinking of other stuff that we could potentially keep doing to keep the podcast running.
Oh, there's so much. There's so much that you guys could do content wise. Even after you're done with the scenes, and people want the content. So yeah. I do. Yeah. Anyway, tangent, but yes, I'm sure people would love to hear you guys tackle some stuff like that too.
I'd be down.
Yay. Cause I've been thinking, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot more we could probably do. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we see that Cal is also a terrible shot.
He's a stormtrooper.
That was
no way. Is that is that the reference?
Yes!
Yes!
That you talked about earlier?
Because, oh my god, this is crazy. Okay, yeah. So, there's a great video called Titanic Super 3D, and it's on YouTube. It came out back in, like, 2012, I think, when the first 3D re-release happened. Mm-hmm. And these guys were just kind of making fun of the idea of Titanic coming out in 3D, and they're like, Titanic Super 3D! Like, you can feel the action, and they do, like, all these dumb things. And then they just start putting random stuff into Titanic. So they're like, in collaboration with George Lucas, and then they cut to this scene, and they put a stormtrooper into the scene.
Yes. Oh my god.
Shooting back and forth with Cal. That's and it's amazing. Like,
oh, they're like at each other, like going at each other.
Yes. Like it's a blaster shooting at Cal, and you see the rays from the blaster going towards Cal, and then he's shooting back, and then they cut to the stormtrooper.
Oh,
he's
over there.
So it's so that's great.
Insane.
That's amazing.
I was like, my world's colliding.
Just missing each other constantly.
And it looks so real. The job they did that's with cool. the green screening is like perfect.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I got to send you it after this.
Please.
It's so good. The Titanic Star Wars crossover that we needed for the amount of times we talk about both on this podcast.
We talk Star Wars off Mike all the time.
Oh man. Anyway, so at this point they've finally made it to the bottom at where the dining room is, which is interesting as well. This is another area that we saw earlier in the movie, which now we're seeing it
underwater.
Sinking.
Yeah.
And it was like a big place in the movie, interestingly enough, where the three of them were together. They were once, you know, down at this first class area together, and now it's a very different scene, very different situation. And Cal doesn't even notice that he is in freezing water on a sinking ship.
Almost waist deep.
Yep. Waist deep until he runs out of ammo and he's like, ah!
Yeah. Oh. It's pure adrenaline. Like, yeah, just not even aware. Yeah, he's, I mean, in that water, we know how cold it is. I mean, if you were up to your hip, that would be to suddenly realize that that's intense pain.
Yeah.
Like intense
the
pain.
Needles. Yeah.
Yep. And so he delivers the classic line.
I hope you enjoy your time together.
Time together. Like, it's very like, it's almost like British. Yeah.
And my mom always hated his line delivery here. And she also hated the look on his face. He has the fluttering melodramatic eyes.
Yeah. And his wig, it's like one of the moments where it's very apparent it's a wig.
It's like falling down.
Yeah. It's usually through most of the movie, it's a pretty good wig. But I think this is probably the moment when I was younger that I realized like, yeah, like that is not Billy Zane. Like it's just falling weirdly. I'm like, that is not Billy Zane's hair. I love how he does like his hand on his hip, you know, kind of like he's giving up. Like,
it's too much
now.
Like, well, I did just get my workout in for the day running all down all these flights of stairs.
Yeah.
So we see Jack and Rose run away through the dining room, which is dry because it's on the incline. Is that correct, would you say? Is that the direction it would have?
I've never really thought about that. I've always just in my head envisioned it like the movie.
Yeah.
But hold on, let me think. Yes, I think that is accurate. I'm envisioning it sinking, and I'm just thinking about like how the dining room was laid out. Yes,
because they're running towards the back of the dining room.
Yes, so yes, I believe so. I think that's correct. And knowing James Cameron, I'm sure it is.
He probably would have known that. Yeah. Because I think some people have pointed out that it looks like the lights are on, but I think that was something else as well. Like, I mean, like it looks like it's daytime outside or something like that. Like there's just like all the windows are just illuminated.
It's just I see what they're saying, but I think it's the windows.
Yeah.
But like, is that like what it was like on the Titanic? Was there like some sort of illumination if the lights were on or?
In the dining room, there were these really thick windows.
Mm.
And so if you had, like they were designed to look almost like if you go to like a pub at night and the thick windows or stained glass windows kind of illuminate and look sort of smoky. Like that's what they were designed for. And so it was probably like the way that light reflected off of those in the dimmer light of the evening, like that's the effect, like
refracting
that they
were going
for.
It kind of,
right.
Yeah,
like refracting cool. light. Okay. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And when they in the expeditions to the wreck, when they've found, you know, areas of the dining room, that's one of the big things that they comment on is like how thick those windows are and how if you, I think there's actually, I can't remember, it may be in Ghosts of the Abyss when Cameron went down there one time, but there's a scene where the lights from the sub like bounce off of the windows in the dining room. And that's what they talk about is just that, wow, it sort of feels like we're in the dining room about to eat, you know, because it to see like light doesn't typically see this area anymore at the bottom of the ocean, and to see light refracting is the perfect word, reflecting, reflect, like that the sub sort of created that same effect that they were going for.
Wow, that's cool.
And that it was very eerie. Yeah, that it was very eerie and very just like surreal for them to see that. The dining room is beautiful.
The dining room set in this movie as well. Yeah. Like,
which is accurate. It's as accurate as... There's a few details that we don't know because there's actually only one surviving photo of the dining room and it's very... You know, it's
to the best of their ability.
We do have obviously all the information from like the Olympic and the sister ships, but I think Cameron, everything that he could replicate, he 100% did.
But I just think it's funny because I've seen people try to say about the dining room windows, they're like, James Cameron messed up big time. It looks like it's daytime outside, but we all know this scene's happening at night.
He would have not made that mistake.
Yeah. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
So, LA, as a historian, like, is there anything that is kind of a, like, not egregious, but maybe not accurate that you've noticed that maybe doesn't get talked about? Or is it pretty spot on, like, for the most part?
You know, obviously the Murdoch stuff.
Yeah. Which we still haven't gotten to the end of that.
End of it.
You haven't gotten to that, so I don't want to like steal any thunder on that, but he's had to make some apologies about that, like that, you know, there's no historical basis for how he writes Murdoch. And then the other one that's big does get talked about a lot, which is, you know, he does choose to go with the very stereotypical Margaret Brown as, you know, Molly Brown.
Salt of the earth.
kind of wild Western accent, big and boisterous. But, you know, she never actually went by Molly.
Yep.
She this persona, that was not her persona. She was actually pretty serious by all accounts.
It was like a mythology maybe more so. Yeah,
that's the Molly Brown stuff is totally mythology.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the big ones. But I see why he wrote the character the way that he did. Aside from that, I mean, I think the only things are just nitpicky things.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people in the Titanic community that will dissect it until the cows come home. But I think if you take the movie, every scene that is set in 1912, there's never been a more accurate depiction of Titanic. And I don't think there ever will be. Like the amount of attention he put toward, I mean, everything you guys have talked about, from the dishware to the silverware to the carpet. People make the argument that more historical moments and passengers should have made it in. I think when historians have a problem with it, it's often with about the absence of some things. They wish there was more Ida and Isidore Strauss. They wish there was more third class actual passengers, you know.
Or second class.
Yeah. And there's a complete absence of second class. So I think any quote unquote lack of accuracy is more in just the absence of things that people wish that we'd seen more of. But there's no time. I mean, in order to do that, he would have had to make a 4-hour movie, but yeah. But in terms of the passengers and crew that he did feature and the ship itself, I mean, I've never been able to poke any real holes in it.
Yeah. Like, he included everything he needed to include to be able to tell the story of Titanic on a massive, major pop cultural scale.
And he obviously cut out a lot of stuff that he shot, you know, everything with the Californian. Mm-hmm. There are actors who had whole roles that were cut because of them cutting the Californian stuff. And so, you know, there's so much more that he, you know, everything with the wireless operators, with Bride and Phillips. Yep. Like, he wanted to show us a lot more of that, but knew in order to get this movie down to a digestible format. But anyway, that's a very long answer to your question, which is, I think it's incredibly accurate. And there's no glaring mistakes that I've ever really been able to pinpoint.
And he does it so well. He paints the world so well that no one needs to go back and do this again.
There's no. Yeah. And I think there definitely could be some, you know, some people have made the argument that, you know, a Netflix limited series would be great to maybe just like focus in and look at some different passengers. I could totally see that.
Yeah.
But in terms of just doing a standalone film,
you can't.
It's going to be a lot of years. There's no way, no one's ever going to tackle this. I think could see a miniseries.
Because there have been miniseries since Titanic.
Oh, yeah. And this is going to sound like a plug for my podcast. I promise it's not. But if anybody listening is interested in some of the, I mean, I guess it is a plug, but I'm just.
Please plug it. No, seriously. No, you can plug it.
But if any, but if you're listening to this and you are interested in the other adaptations, you know, I have a kind of a side series that I pop in and do on the feed a few times a year while I do Titanic on film, colon, this film or this mini series. And so I've covered Ghosts of the Abyss, some of the documentaries. I've covered the 1953 Hollywood Titanic. I've covered A Night to Remember. So just, you know, the 2012 Julian Fellows miniseries. So yeah, if you're listening and it's, and you think like, oh wow, yeah, that is kind of fun to think about the different interpretations, because some of them are wildly inaccurate.
Or just like not very good.
Or just not very good. The first one I ever did was the 1996 miniseries with Catherine Zeta-Jones that came out right before the 97 movie. And it's so bad. It's such, it's a piece of work, man. So if you're going to listen to one of mine, start with that one. The research that I do for those are fun because I'll go back and do some film history and talk about the making of, like before I get to what's accurate, what's not, I do a lot of build up with the film history. Yeah. Anyway, it's just, if anyone's interested, like I have looked at a lot of the different ones and they're all, they're all just their own animals. That's cool.
Sorry for laughing just randomly. I was thinking, Ethan, when I was thinking of other things we could do, and now that you know you're talking about other Titanic stuff, I was like, Ethan, knowing us, like the way we like to just laugh and break things down that are ridiculous, we should watch Titanic 2 on this podcast and break it down.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, do it. I will listen.
Like a one-off episode on Titanic 2, and it's just nothing but us just dying laughing at the ridiculousness.
And then you could do Titanic 666.
Yep, there's Titanic 666 as well.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
A horror movie that just came out last year or this year. All right, so to wrap the scene up. So Cal starts to chuckle to himself. He just starts laughing. And then Lovejoy has made his way down the stairs, took his time to get down there, and asks him what could possibly be funny. And this is when Cal says,
I put the diamond in the coat.
And I put the coat on her!
the pause. Yeah. The phrasing of the line, it's just, there's so many ways you probably could have said this, but, you know, Billy Zane, of course, this is how he delivers it. Just classic, iconic, everything. And again, that's the moment where we're suddenly like, oh, suddenly we care about the diamond again.
Yep, it pops in when it needs to work for us.
Yep. Yeah, so that is the end of the scene. Yeah, wow.
This is a marathon, man. We really...
I know. I can't believe we made it through all of my 7 pages. I was getting scared.
This is the beauty of this format. Like, I love it. Like, and I'm like an always-on podcast listener as well as, you know, a podcaster. Mm-hmm. And so I think people love this content. I think, like, most people that listen to your podcast probably love it when the episode length is really long, when they open up their feed and they see a post and the longer it is. I mean, that's how it always is for me.
Yeah, that's how I think too about a podcast I listen to.
When you guys post one and I see that it's on the longer end, I'm like, yes, because I like, whether I'm cleaning or I'm running or I'm out running errands or whatever it may be, it's awesome. It's like, you know, you press play and you're just gonna chill with your podcasters that you like for a while. And so it's good. Well, this has been so much fun.
It really has. Yeah,
this is awesome. Thank you.
Thank y'all so much for having me on.
This is like definitely hands down one of our best episodes ever, I think.
Yeah, this is a fun one.
I think when you post this and then I'm also like allowed to post it on Insta and sort of announce it, people are going to go crazy because I will tell you, I get so many messages from listeners that, you know, are like, wait, do you know about Scene by Scene? I'm like, no, wait. Of course I do. I think there's a lot of cross-pollination, so I think people are going to be really excited, and I could stay and talk for hours. Yeah. Like, I wish we had longer. Like, this has been so much fun.
We'll have you back, so. I think. Yeah,
we'll have
fun
to have you on again. Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh my God, dude, seriously, anytime, and if you ever want to do, like, a side episode on another movie, or yeah. I mean, I love film history as well. So please, and let's talk in the fall. I'm about to go on hiatus now, but you guys should come on Unsinkable too. We can do like a total cross promotion, but y'all should pop on and we could just talk about whatever.
No, I'd be down.
I know. Yeah. It's just so cool. This was literally, this was so much fun. I feel like we got into so many good things. I don't know. The vibes were just awesome.
It was fantastic. I think we all like fed off of each other really well. I think we all came in with like a few bullet points that were good, but I think those bullet points were improved
exactly
bouncing off of each other. So
exactly. Yay. That's why it's so great to have a third voice in the mix. Like I was saying, it's so good, so fun. And I'm glad that we're doing this and having other people come on, especially you. I knew it would be great. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you. Anytime, seriously, and I really cannot wait to tell listeners that this happened. I've kept it a secret. I was like, I'm going to do like a reveal on Instagram. This is like a very big deal. This is an epic crossover. So thank you guys. I know we're all in different time zones, but whatever rest of the night you have an amazing night.
You too.
And, thank you.
Yeah.
And we'll put all of your information in the description so everybody who maybe is not familiar can go follow you.
Oh, yeah. And I'm really easy to find if you search Unsinkable on Apple Pods. If you search Unsinkable Pod on Instagram, I'll pop right up. So, yeah, super easy to find.
Awesome. Thank you again so much. This was so much fun.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
So thank you guys so much for listening. This was so much fun. We really, really appreciate it. We hope you guys had as good a time listening to us chatting with LA about this wonderful scene as much as we did talking about it. Can't wait to maybe have her on again someday and speak with some other people as we make our way towards the end of the movie, which is just insane. But thank you guys so much for listening. Follow us on all of the socials. You'll be able to find all of LA's socials in the description as well. Be sure to follow the Unsinkable Pod. Send us an email, titanicscenebyscene@gmail.com. Follow Ethan and I on Letterboxd. All of the good stuff. And we will see you in the next scene.
See ya.